Okay, so week two is the one I told you you can't miss, and I almost missed it because my alarm didn't go off, but mercifully my wake-up service called me. Anselm the Realist is the title of this. Let me just get up there the outline today. I'm going to start with the idea of universals, and of course this is Anselm's thoughts on it, but I think in a very concise way, he represents, I think, a good chunk of the Christian tradition. Anselm on predicates, and once you understand what a universal is, you'll have a new idea of what a predicate is. And you'll realize that you probably never really believed in them, and that atheists cannot believe in predicates or sentences. But we'll get to that. Third, Anselm on truth. Fourthly, Anselm on meaning. And then I kind of added a fifth practical application section, Anselm on doctrine, because sprinkled throughout these three writings, at least, or four if you count the Monologion, because he talks a lot about that in that book as well, he's going to draw out doctrinal implications of this idea. We mentioned by way of introduction that Anselm is considered to be, by many people, the father of medieval scholasticism. So when we talk about the words realism today, and scholasticism, draw an arrow from realism to scholasticism. Realism is the doctrine, the philosophy, and scholasticism is the method or the school that emerged to defend it. And the kids right now in history are learning today, in fact, all about the Carolingian dynasty, Charlemagne, and the intellectual revolution that he spawned at the very end of the 8th century, turned to the 9th century, and particularly with the help of a man named Alcuin of York, who was part of the British at that time. The British schools were the ones that were most responsible for bringing Europe out of the Dark Ages. It wasn't just the monks copying texts, it was that too. But it's specifically this doctrine in their schools between the 8th and the 9th century that then filtered down through Charlemagne's court to the Franks, and then all Western Europe was defending this doctrine. But it had enemies right from the beginning, too. So our job today is to see, what is it? Why is it important? Who were its main opponents? And what were they saying? And, you know, who's right? So the big idea... Oh, by the way, I might have a different big idea on yours than I do on the kids. This is literally the kids' version that I gave you, because it's got that grammar on it. I just didn't have time this week, so I gave you the kids' version. Which has my notes spilled out for them, because I kind of deviate when I talk to the kids, because this is going to be like closest you've had to my actual manuscript notes, which I will deviate from also. But, yeah, I did. The big idea on this is that as realism goes, so does rationality and civilization. The way I had it on here in the original notes was, according to Anselm and his tradition, as the fortress of realism falls, all hell breaks loose. So that's the claim. As realism goes, so does rationality and civilization. All the best Christian thinkers in the early Middle Ages especially, but through Aquinas, and there were still some people in the late Middle Ages, believed that realism is just synonymous, it's just the philosophy for which monotheism is the theology. If realism falls, Christianity falls. Realism is theism, theism is realism. Virtually all conservative evangelical scholars today reject realism in favor of nominalism. All the good teachers you're thinking of reject realism. Now, in their case, they don't really know what it is. They're not philosophers. They have no understanding of what they're talking about. In their books put out by Crossway, InterVarsity Press, they'll speak of things like chastened realism, which I'm not sure who got the spanking and when, but they'll talk about critical realism in N.T. Wright's case and a lot of other people. These people have no idea what they're talking about, and today we're going to start to see what that's all about. So let's get right to this idea of universals. Anselm on universals. Now, if you don't grow up in a Christian home and you discover Christianity by reading Augustine or Thomas Aquinas or C.S. Lewis, and you first learn about universals and you read in Plato's dialogues how this works, your mind just comes alive. You read passages like Luke 18 where Jesus is talking to the rich young ruler and the rich young ruler says, "Good teacher," and he says, "Why do you call me good? Don't you know that God alone is good?" And the rich young ruler sees all these good things
He says, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life?
And he says, you know the commandments. The rich young ruler replies to him, all these things I've done.
Let's call this one thing one, thing two, thing three, and so on and so forth. What does Jesus say?
One thing you lack.
And you know the rest of the story.
You see it everywhere in Scripture. You see it in Plato's dialogues. You see it in Augustine. You see it in Aquinas. You see it in C.S. Lewis. You see it in Christian apologists. And then you come into the church. And you pick up all the books written by all the smart theologians. And they reject it. And you're like, what the heck? Who's running this show? That's what we're talking about today. Anselm on universals. Scholasticism in the Middle Ages was built around the core of realism. So what is realism? Realism is the philosophical doctrine that universals are real, hence the name, entities. They are eternal and intelligible to the mind. What are universals? I can't just say, well, they're eternal and intelligible. Okay, those are predicates of it. What are they? Well, we're talking about things like truth, beauty, goodness, justice, oneness, redness, and anything else-ness you can possibly think of-ness. These are either real realities to which our words correspond, or else not one single one of our words has any fixed meaning. Now, Augustine and other contributors in the century after him, like Boethius, had taught Christian scholars to conceive of realism in the lingo of Aristotle, but very much still in the vision of Plato. And one of the most important Platonic aspects to this synthesis that's almost never understood by its critics is the difference between being and what all these things are doing down here, the particulars. And Plato called this participation in being. In other words, nothing that is an effect has the power of being within itself. These things are merely participating in being. Now that might seem a little mystical at first, but just bear with me. But the real difference up front is simply that universals are the essence of a thing, the essence of goodness, the essence of justice, the essence of beauty. And a particular is, for example, a beautiful flower. Beautiful is a good one to use. Because I always ask the kids, I show them a flower, it's in full bloom. I say, what is this? They say, it's a flower. I say, is that beautiful? They say, yeah, it's beautiful. I say, well, look at the word beautiful. It's full of beauty. Now, how did it get that way? Now, I show them step two, and I show them the flower wilted. And I say, what's that? And they say, that's the flower. I say, is that the same flower? Yep, it's the same flower. It's ugly, though, isn't it? Yeah. It's not the same thing, though, is it? That's a beautiful thing, and that's an ugly thing. And they say, no, it's the same thing. I say, well, what happened? Did somebody take out the beauty? It was full of beauty. Did somebody pour it out? What Plato would say, or what Augustine would say, or any of those thinkers, is to say that this thing at that moment was participating in beauty. It was full of beauty. It was more accurately reflecting beauty at that moment. And then in the next moment, as all the particles changed, as decomposition happened, it's fallen away from the essence of beauty, no longer resembling it. So each particular thing in this world, be it a physical object or an event, was an expression, or a combination of expressions, of an essential essence or form. Now, Aristotle would describe this a little bit differently than Plato. He would hold that there is never any form apart from its matter. So he agreed that there was an eternal form of things, but those things always existed in their present shape, that you see it, the matter. Plato would say that such predicates that belong to the form, any particular thing, are nothing but the instances of the eternal essence of thing, a copy of the way things are in heaven, so to speak. So a red rose is participating in the reality of redness. And a pair of twins are exemplifying or participating in the essence of duality. Duality or two-ness was not created when the twins were conceived. The twins conform to a reality that was there before they were. There is not one predicate of a thing that passes in and out of existence that can be reduced to that particular thing. When the rose wilts or burns in a fire, redness does not cease to be. but simply the particles in that rose change form. Or else, if that were not true, the individual quality, the predicate, say redness, would pass out of existence with it. Human beings can only speak meaningfully if each word that we use about diverse things really corresponds to something that exists above and beyond the subject for which they form the predicate. So the simplest way to see this is just in regular language. Here, when I say subject, I'm just talking linguistically. I'm not talking about the human subject, the knower. You have a subject, and you have a predicate, or a series of predicates. Okay? So the subject is what Aristotle would call a substance, a particular thing. Evangelicals also came into contact with this idea through Francis Schaeffer's books, but we're not allowed to think like that anymore either. He would make the distinction between a particular as opposed to a universal. So whether you call this a particular or a substance, it doesn't really matter, or in a sentence, a subject, that's the thing you're talking about. If it's in this world as a finite thing, it is an effect. All of its predicates, you have to ask yourself, do the predicates have independent existence of that thing, or are they reducible to that thing? That's really the ultimate question. So each predicate has a meaning over a range of things that we call a class or a category, and hence the word universal for such a metaphysical essence refers to the sense in which this thing, this idea, object, this predicate, provides a unity to the diversity of things that are species of it. So, for example, triangularity, color, hardness, height. This thing, for example, if it's high, say that mountain is high. Is highness reducible to that mountain? Did height pop into existence when the mountain formed? And every time that the mountain decomposes at every second, height decomposes with it? Well, clearly not. The thing is either a thing, or it is a useful word we are attaching to some kind of relation. So the debate was between realism versus the other view, nominalism, and this. Now, over here, this comes from the Latin word for thing, res. This belief that these were things. This view came from the Latin word nomen, which means name. A nominalist says that universals are just useful names that we ascribe to relationships that we see. We abstract from the things that we see. So I look at that and I see time over there. In fact, over there. Those words aren't, they don't correspond to actual things. They're useful names that we give to the abstractions we make about things. Of course, none of those things are actually things, as it turns out. Now, they don't see the contradiction at all. By the way, when you hear the word nominalist Christian, a Christian that is only so in name, that is a direct result of nominalism in philosophy. Nominalism is atheistic language theory. Nominalism is naturalistic language theory. It denies the reality of things to which our language corresponds, which if a consistent nominalist would not speak. He would not actually mean an object by any word that he uses. Now, critics of realism fool themselves by only treating justice, goodness, beauty, over-there-ness, really abstract things, not like, hardness. But I already showed you with height that that won't work about physical things, because there's nothing there except for predicates. Okay? So a nominalist, if he's consistent, will believe in nothing, which is why nominalism leads directly to skepticism and atheism and agnosticism. But that's what, so when you think of universal, think of predicate. When you think of predicate, think of a universal. Or at least something at that moment that's more universal than the particular thing that it belongs to. The essence of motion, for example, enables the mind to classify moving things as all that which changes position. And it allows us to distinguish moving things from non-moving things. It makes communication possible, and it makes further learning possible, which is why if you have realism, you get universities. Voila! Universities came out of the realist school in medieval Europe. Universities became pluralversities, and then finally perversities as soon as nominalism won. With realism, you get schools, you get education, you get modern medicine, you get a scientific revolution. You get everything good in life. With nominalism, you're going to be picking bugs and berries again, and people will be attacking your civilization within a couple of years. And that's exactly what happened. From a Christian perspective, or at least to be more modest at the beginning, from an early medieval scholastic perspective, the criticisms of realism exist because such people do not understand the thing that they are criticizing. One can no more use thought and speech to criticize realism than one can refute the existence of air by breathing, or the existence of evil by grumbling. One stands inside the other. Now, right after the generation of Anselm, the realist camp suffered the always annoying PR blunder of one of its own living up to the caricature. What you're going to find in the 11th, 12th, and 13th century is a bunch of people who, and the historians never tire bringing up these people and not the people that defended it right, who defended it on silly grounds that became the source of the caricature. For example, one guy named Odo of Tournai insisted that, quote, when a new human being comes into existence, what happens is not that a new substance is produced, but only a new property of an already existing substance. So let me show you why somebody would think something like that. If I'm a realist, and I believe that the only thing that ultimately exists are things in heaven, eternal attributes, then, for example, the universal human or man, whatever, every time there's a birth, you don't have something of the power of being within itself, but you have something that's entirely reducible to its predicates, which predicates have to be real things. So when a new human being is produced, it's not that you have an actual real substance, an individual thing, but you actually have the essence of human being being exemplified here and here, and turns out that this is the same substance. In fact, Socrates is Plato and Plato is Socrates. They're just two parts of each other. You got disjointed and stuff like that. So this is the kind of thing people have in mind by realism, and that becomes the object of their criticism. Well, this is not how either Plato or Aristotle would have understood it. It's not the way Augustine or Boethius before this time would have previously stated things. And what's worse, this is labeled by historians often extreme realism or ultra realism, which, much like empty labels like hyper-Calvinism, give off the impression that this is realism in its essence, so that this is the genuine article and it needs to be modified, if anything. The earliest nominalists, a guy named Eric of Auxerre and Rosselin, which this guy was Anselm's contemporary, they both objected to realism on the grounds that only individual things exist and only outside of the mind. So listen to the criticism against realism by nominalism from the beginning. Only individual things exist and only outside of the mind. So how does that attack realism? What is the assumption there? Well, it didn't occur to them that monotheistic realism maintained the exact same thing. If God is the ground of all universals, either his attributes or his thoughts, which his thoughts in turn correspond to his attributes, then all universals are likewise one being. One individual being, God. An individual substance, God. To object to realism by insisting that only individuals exist is to commit either the fallacy of the false dilemma. Why false dilemma? Because either there's universals, plural. You already made the mistake right there, which is the straw man fallacy that comes next. Or individuals exist. Well, since you believe only one thing exists, and all other things are parts of that, then clearly individuals, plural, don't exist. That's a false dilemma heaped on top of a straw man. Or you're guilty of the fallacy of begging the question. It really depends on the particular objector, but it's committing one of those fallacies, that particular objection. Now, younger contemporaries of Anselm, they lived about the same generation, a little bit younger than him, though. William of, I don't know how to pronounce this, if it's French, it's probably shampoo. Sorry. Champol. Oh, he is. Or Peter Abelard is the other guy who was kind of debating against him. But William was a realist, and Peter Abelard was not. And we people that understand historic theology, you recognize the name Peter Abelard. Says, oh, he must have won. Oh, great. This is probably the beginning of the demise of realism. Well, they debated this same misunderstanding of realism. It's not really another ultimate question there. But anyway, one historian, F.C. Coppleston, who is in the 20th century, and I think he's going to misunderstand it too, but he said, according to William, one and the same essential nature is present in every member of a given species. So according to William, and realism, obviously, according to this author, one and the same essential nature is present in every member of a given species. So redness, for example, is present in that box of crayons and in the rose. It's the same substance. That's the idea. But that understanding of realism does not follow for the very same reason that the other myth doesn't. If substance of the universal is either an attribute of God or an idea in the mind of God, then it is not that the substance is in each particular member of the class. You know, the redness is not reducible to the rose. That's our whole point. The height is not in the mountain, in the rock, in the particular kind of rock that it is. Rather, the particular is participating in the being of God. When Abelard contested that this leads to a kind of monism or pantheism, William was said to modify his realism and suggest that the members of the same species are not the same essentially, but indifferently. In other words, these qualities are numerically the same as each other. So Plato and Socrates, both, one of them is a man and the other is a man. But they're not substantially the same thing. So he kind of backed off from his realism. Moral of the story, realism lost. Well, they lost a PR war, but they didn't actually lose an argument. By the way, this is where it's at the end, if we have time. This is going to be very, very important to the doctrine of transubstantiation. Anselm and realists are actually going to disagree with the doctrine of transubstantiation very early on, which might come as a surprise to a lot of historic theologians. It was the realists who opposed it at first. Now, it's true that Aristotle's language became the language that was used in the Catholic Church, but they used Aristotle's language wrong to justify that position. Sproul has a lot of good sections on that in various books, how the doctrine of transubstantiation actually contradicted Aristotle as well as the scriptures. But that's another thing for another day. But here we have a valuable lesson. This is our longest section on universals. But this is a valuable lesson on how special revelation informs and protects general revelation. Some of you might be asking yourself, is this anywhere in scripture? Glad you asked. I'm going to get to it just in a second. But this is a lesson in how special revelation helps us, informs us, protects what we're getting from general revelation. Let me illustrate with one of the finest historians of philosophy in the past century, a guy named F.C. Copleston. Now, Copleston was a Jesuit philosopher. He debated Bertrand Russell, and he, in the words of one historian of philosophy, he cleaned Bertie's clock. He really decimated the atheist Bertrand Russell in that debate. But Copleston's a Jesuit, and Jesuits are really good at two things. They're good at thinking and plotting assassinations. And you have to do a lot of thinking to do that. I'm just kidding. If a Jesuit, I don't know what our stats are for the Jesuits on sermonaudio.com, but they're really good thinkers. That's the point. But he blew it on this one because he lacked the intellectual categories necessary to grasp this idea. He would call it ultra-realism. Now, these are categories that are specifically etched on the mind by very clear scripture. And I give a lot of scriptures, but I'm only going to give three. But here's the point. In his book, Medieval Philosophy, Copleston demonstrates a lack of understanding both of realism in general and the use of participation in particular and how that would have solved his problem. Now, he charitably attempts to summarize Anselm's ultra-realism, as he calls it, as follows. He says, quote, Anselm does use ultra-realistic language, which would imply that there is a kind of form of goodness which is actually shared in by all good things. You mean like Jesus in Luke 18? But we'll just leave that on the side for a second. But to participate in goodness or in being really means for him to possess being or goodness in dependence on a cause. Now, the student of Scripture will recognize, hopefully eventually as you study these things, the idea of being and participation. Now, the Bible's going to use different language for it. But provided it is explained correctly, we're going to recognize this idea in Scripture as identical to what's being described in passages like these. First one is Acts chapter 7, verse 28. This is Paul talking to the Athenians, and he says about this unknown God, it is in him we live and move and have our being. So let's just start with that. It is in his being that we live and move and have our being. Now, I suppose You might take that to be a very poetic thing. Well, I don't know what that means, so maybe it doesn't mean anything. And we don't say things like that. But you do gloss over Scripture when you get exhausted with an idea or you just don't know what to make of it. But it literally means that. In Him, we live and move and have our being. That does not mean that we are a part of His being. That's pantheism. That's monism. But it does mean that the being of God upholds our being. We don't have independent power of being. And I give you lots of scriptures for that. Let's move on to Romans 1:20. This is where you're going to tackle the predicates, universals as predicates. Listen carefully to what Paul claims here. For His invisible attributes, that's God's invisible attributes, for His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. What did Paul just say? The things of God are clearly seen in the things that have been made. Things, plural, of God, namely His attributes, are seen in the things that have been made. Does that mean that God's justice localizes? And here we're not talking about the incarnation. In anywhere else in creation, does the divine nature become the created nature? No. Now, the divine nature, by definition, cannot become creaturely. So what does he mean? He means that the attributes of God are on display in all of the things that have been made. Psalm 19, 1 through 3 says the same thing. In fact, Psalm 19, again, you could reduce it to poetry if you want, makes the claim that there is no voice or speech. In other words, it's a poetic way of saying there is no predicate you can look at in all creation of anything that is not saying something about God. Now, you can't really say something about God if those things aren't things. You have to say something about God. Now, His attributes are not parts. They're not divisible. They're aspects of His unified being, which we'll get to more and more. The point is that these verses are saying that this is what the world is made of. Only things that point to things about God, which are things. They're real things. They were things before we attached words to them. They'll be things when we're rotting in the ground. They are what they are. Hebrews 8:5 and 9:23 and 9:24. There's one other verse in Hebrews and I couldn't find it. But it says, these things serve as a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. And there it's talking about the sacrificial system in the Old Testament. These things down here, even the highest things of religion, the things that you can see that are phenomenological, the temple, things that God instituted. He's not saying they're unimportant. But these are only copies, shadows of the way things are eternally. So question, does the Bible teach realism? Yes. The Bible teaches realism, and nominalism makes no sense of anything, let alone the Bible. Not only has God created and maintained the world toward the end that all should speak about Him, but in that very act, every single predicate of each particular thing is reflecting a real thing about God. Monotheistic realism has a very specific thing in mind by participation in being. And if you don't criticize that, you're really not criticizing the same thing. Anselm meant what the apostles meant. These things are indeed things, reality. And these things are divine things. They're not materially in things. I'm going to make up a word, at least according to my spell checker. They are instantially through things. Philosophers use the word instantiated. In other words, justice is being exemplified by a judge who slams the gavel down and renders a just ruling. He is conforming to justice. Justice didn't pop out of the piece of wood on his... You know, I hate to reduce it to something so childish, but that's your alternative. That's the opposite of realism. Insanity. All right, these four sections are going to be really quick implications of everything we just talked about. Anselm on predicates. To understand the philosophical works of the earliest scholastics, one has to know a thing or two about the ABCs of Aristotle's thought. And I already hinted at it down there with substance. But you have to begin with that most basic of Aristotle's 10 categories, substance, by which he just meant any particular thing. And he meant thing down here in the material world, something you can see, something that you usually attach predicates to, whether it's a proper noun or just that wall over there. In the categories, we might remember that Aristotle divided substance between primary substance and secondary substance. But unlike Plato, he put primary substance down here in this world, particular things, and secondary substance up here. So he agreed with Plato that the essence of things exists. So up here, Aristotle did not deny that universals had existence. Aristotle was a realist. Some people think Aristotle was a nominalist. Those people should be carted off far away from children in universities because they don't understand what they're reading. Aristotle started from a different place than Plato did, in particulars down here, but he did not deny the reality of form or universals, or that they are real things. He just made one primary, a particular thing, and one secondary, also a particular thing. Man is a particular thing. Okay? Now, it's complex and kind of irrelevant to our class as far as how he disagreed with Plato on that point, but Anselm summarizes everything in this way. He says, quote, "Now, substance is analyzed into universal substance and individual substance." Analyzed, he just means broken down into those two categories. "A universal substance is one whose essence is shared by several substances." So again, redness, oneness. "Thus, being human is what individual humans have in common. An individual substance shares in a universal essence." The way we say this in logic is this. Anytime we make a statement about a particular thing or a universal class of things, we'll say something like, "All bears are mammals." So what we mean by that is everywhere you see a bear, there you'll see a mammal. Okay? The predicate is, in that sense, bigger than the subject. Anytime you're talking about a particular thing, unless you're talking about an eternal thing, the predicate is always bigger than the subject. Why is that? So pick a sentence, any sentence. Somebody raise your hand and pick a sentence. Then you can come up with a counterexample. Yep.
I'll
just say a thing then.
That board is green.
That board is green. Let's say I painted it red right there. Or I could extract all the different particles that are green. Would green still exist? Yeah. Okay. So anytime I say universally all S is P, or even a particular statement, S is P, the predicate is always bigger than the subject. That's not a name, a useful thing we've devised to say about nothing. It's something. The predicate has independent existence, exists above and beyond each particular thing that passes in and out of existence. Which is why, again, naturalists can't believe in language and in meaning. And it's why they typically don't as their philosophy progresses or regresses. But that's what a predicate is. All predicates are universals. The words that we use for each and every predicate signify a reality which transcends the particular, which is the subject of the sentence. Now, this process cannot go on forever, because that predicate in turn is the subject of another predicate. So all men are rational. All rational is thinking. All thinking is something. Or all Englanders are white. All white is something. Now you notice other things are white that are not Englishmen, and other things. And that process cannot go on forever. But there has to be a first cause of predication. There has to be something which simply is its own essence, and this being we call God. But Anselm didn't go that far in this particular book. He's just drawing out the grammar of it. But here's the point. What does nominalism do to predicates? Well, if universals are mere words, useful ape gruntings that we attach to whatever, and only individual substances exist apart from their qualities, well, then nothing is anything else. All predication is a mere description of a bare subject. And a bare subject, I had trouble typing that because that's kind of like a square circle. A subject with no predicates. If everything is simply an individual without any predication, then nothing is anything. Which is why consistent atheists can't believe in anything. I know. Magic trick. It's early. It's magic. No, it's actually literally true when you analyze that. And now, most people that you ever talk to will have no idea what you just said if you say that. You got to help them out with that. But it's still true. And this brings up the fact that realism has many crossroads because reality has many crossroads. The intersection between this or that genus and species is often a few trees in a forest that cry out for a broader lens. Again, what we showed there. Predicates like literate and white are the ones that Anselm worked with throughout this whole book. I actually tortured it to death, and he's actually got a little boring and monotonous. But anyway, he looked at those predicates. Literate and white are both incidental to man, and this distinguishes between some species of the genus from others. Yet literacy is more proper to the nature of man than whiteness, since many non-men are white. Yet no non-man on earth is literate. Moreover, the same word can be used, or can be variously categorized. White can be both a quality and possess qualities itself. So again, there's going to be some complexity here. There's going to be hierarchies. There's going to be some things that attach to one thing and not to other things that it seems to. So this is going to open up a whole universe of meaning here. Anselm on truth. I'll try to get through this here. How are we doing? Truth and meaning. Okay. I kind of talked about this last Thursday night a little bit, so I'll give you sort of a synopsis. But the most important thing, I guess that I didn't cover last Thursday night, is how realism and objectivism, again, we're using those two words objectively and really, which we're just being consistent with our view. Realism is going to refer to the metaphysic, and objectivism is going to refer to the epistemology. And the flow is going to go this way, away from the subject who's looking this way, to the whatever object it is. Okay, so that's kind of be the chart that we work off of here. But here's the key. Because things are real, the knowledge of things will also be real. So you're dealing with two objects. If you're a realist, you have to be an objectivist. But if you're an objectivist, you have to be a realist. Because things are real, the knowledge of things is also a thing. And therefore, it's real. Because if it wasn't the case, then two minds couldn't agree on any particular thing. Because the thing called that body or that unit of knowledge would have to transcend both of their minds. It couldn't be utterly different in both of their minds. So because the reality of things is independent of the effects of finite reason, both the objects of knowledge, that's what knowers know, the objects of knowledge, and that knowledge itself, knowers knowing, will be precisely objects, substantial and independent of finite reasoning. Knowledge, if it's real knowledge, is independent of your finite reasoning. This is why rationalism is irrational. Rationalism started to define reason as the reason determining what's true. In the classical tradition and in the Christian tradition, reason was discovering what's true, which means that your reason is always an effect of revelation. And that's why revelation, being the substance of all knowledge, is necessary to realism and objectivism. If you have a finite mind, all of your knowledge is going to be an effect. It's going to be an existing thing that is invading your mind. It's affecting your mind. It's not being produced by your mind. So the objective is always the cause of the subjective in both metaphysics and epistemology, or else it is neither real nor objective. So let's talk a little bit, review what we did last Thursday night just in a different way. Truth has to be an attribute of eternity. Anselm tackled this question. What did he mean by this? Well, he analyzed this idea of something happening in the future. He basically says X is going to happen in the future. Now let's assume that this is true. When does it start to be true? When was it ever false? Could it have been ever false? X is going to have happened. Could that ever be false? Could it ever be not true? Could it ever not exist as a truth? Now again, assuming that this statement is true, when will it cease being true? And what he concluded is there is no conceivable time when. And add to this the fact that neither statement can be true without truth. And his conclusion? is that truth has no conceivable beginning or end. It couldn't, or no statement about any finite thing could be true. If it is 747 is true now, I always trick the kids with this in the first year, in 1 minute will that be true? Right. The reference will be true. Now, there's a difference between sense and referent, which we're going to get to in a second. But the object that that knowledge represents is eternally true, or else it is not true at all. If it is a changeable truth, that's like a square circle, a changeable truth is no truth at all. Now, to the question of universal truth, Anselm asks, we ask then whether there is only one truth in all the things in which we say truth is, or as many truths as there are things called true. Now, to answer this, Anselm first points out that what he had already called rectitude, later philosophers would call this correspondence. In other words, truth is the idea in my mind. Yeah, this is the way I did it on that board over there, so let me just do that again. Tree, idea of a tree. And so the object we're going to work with is the object of a tree. So, whether there is only one truth in all things, that's the universal, or as many truths as there are things called true. Now, that might seem like a false dilemma at first, but just hang with it for a second. To answer this, Anselm first points out that what he'd already called rectitude or correspondence does not depend on signification. So let's make a distinction here. Let's open this guy's mouth like kind of like Pac-Man. That's going to be him saying something. So let's make a distinction between signification, which is the word, the symbol, that's symbolizing, hopefully, an object, and what he calls, and let's start this at the mind, because I can have the idea of something and not say it and still be right. This, significations inside of that, he called rectitude, something corresponding to the actual object. That's what truth is. Idea in my mind, accurately representing, replicating the way the real world is. So he says, rectitude does not depend on signification, but signification on rectitude. So that, quote, no signification is correct by any rectitude other than that which remains when signification perishes. Just like that time question I just asked you. Its truth remains whether or not somebody signifies it. And here's where particular truths participate in the being of truth. He says, quote, that signification then comes to be according to a rectitude which always is. And when it means what it should not or nothing at all, it then falls away from a never-failing rectitude. So what Anselm is saying here is that this thing is something subject to do. We make signs. We attempt to, whether just our idea or the word coming out, to signify the thing. But the actual correspondence of knowledge or truth to the thing, to reality, is what it is. It is what it is. It's never something else. It's never the opposite. And if it's ever something else, it is the opposite of what it is. So he draws the whole inference. He says this, quote, if there are as many rectitudes as there are things in which they are considered, it is necessary that they exist and vary as the things themselves do. But this has been shown not to be the case. So there are not many rectitudes, just because rectitude is found in many things. Therefore, there is one and the same rectitude of all. So you have a signer, a sign. You have the truth, which is in this box. This is objective knowledge. And then you have the reality that it's talking about. But this truth over here is true about something. Now, when it's true about a tree, and I say, what's that over there? And you say, a tree. And I say, what do you mean by that? You say, well, it's green, it's brown, it's hard, it's soft, it's tall, it's over there. Oh, it's just like that one. You're immediately talking about things beyond that. Remember? S is P. And this S, in turn, is another P. And that process cannot go on to infinity. But there has to be some truth about which all other truth conforms. And that truth we call God. Why then do we use the expression, the truth of this or that particular thing? Of course, there has to be a distinction between the truth that there are 3 feet in a yard and the truth that Arizona is south of Idaho. Those are two particular truths. They're not the same thing in that sense. But all of the things that are true about any substance, each predicate, as Anselm says, always excels them. He says, for we do not say the time of this or that thing because time is in those things, but because they are in time. So the highest truth subsists in itself and belongs to no thing. Now, Anselm talks about meaning, and he has a very interesting definition of this thing that called natural words, which I think I'm not going to get into, but you have it spelled out in your notes, like I said. But this is very, very crucial, because the difference that philosophers make between sense and referent can only make sense in an objective, realist understanding. Okay, so I would commend that to you to read what Anselm means by a natural word, and study that out. I think you'll find it's very important. So let's get to this last section on doctrine. This is sort of a practical, quick thing. I will mention the thing about will. The point there is that there's a hierarchy there between different kinds of will. Let me just say something about the doctrine of God and the doctrine of Scripture, because I think this will be most immediate ways that this is important. We've said that according to Anselm and his tradition, as the fortress of realism falls, all hell breaks loose. So let's consider for a second why that is. We can get a sense of it in Anselm's definition of the Trinity, which I put that, and then I didn't put down, I think in your notes I actually put the doctrine of God, because I changed course halfway, because the doctrine of God was easier to explain. So I think in your notes it says the doctrine of God. But here's the basic reason why the doctrine of realism the opposite of the doctrine of realism undercuts the doctrine of God. It's because if universals are mere words and only other individual substances exist apart from their qualities, then nothing exists. Nothing is anything else. Nothing is its nature. Nothing is natural in the classical sense of that word. And I think one of the main casualties of the loss of realism is the loss of the meaning of the word natural or nature. In the modern world, when we use the word nature, we mean things as they are down here. Which things? That thing. What is that? And you lost the meaning of what the nature of the thing is. Because nature is no longer now allowed to mean A equals A. It is what it is. It is entirely what it is, and you can't make it something else. There's an immutable way that God has made things. Which, what do you do with that when your worldview only rises as high to say that everything is always changing form? But if everything is always changing form, then nothing is itself. Consistently. If you really believe that consistently, that everything is always changing, then nothing is anything. You can't mean the same thing by A equals A. You can't mean the same thing by nature. And lo and behold, though people don't use these exact words and think through it for more than 30 seconds, you see that in everybody you're talking to. Even people that really have hardcore modernist worldviews. Nobody means anything with any fixity. All predication in that view, in nominalism, is a mere description of a bare subject, which again is a square circle, a contradiction. There's no such thing as a bare subject. There's only things that have natures. To say God is X, pick an attribute, is to affirm in nominalism either nothing or else always something else. Only other individual things exist. Some individual existent which is not the same A as God. Hence, if nominalism is true, God is not God, nothing is anything, but God is not God, but entirely derives his existence from another. And then finally, just think of the Bible for a second. In Anselm's idea of a natural name, which I guess I do have to get into this, I tried to skip it and then I tried to apply this, real quickly though. He says there's 3 basic ways we can mean something. One is the actual sound signal, or ink blots. If I'm writing a book, it's ink blots. If I'm saying something in conversation, it's it's noises. Okay? Secondly, I can do a little bit better than that, and I can actually think of the name just kind of make it stay put, even if I don't say it. Or, thirdly, I can think of the object. Now, by the way, I can give that names, and I can express that. It'll take a little bit longer. And what Anselm is saying is that there's nothing more like reality than this. When we say it that way, it's like, well, yeah. And so, let me read the quote then, back on that other page on meaning. He says, the words of the third and the last kind, since they express things that are known, are natural and the same for all people. That's important. The atonement is, satisfaction means satisfaction in China or America. And so when missiologists today say, oh, you can't say that in China, that won't play. When a Hindu, for example, thinks of the word Lord, he has X, Y, and Z in mind. There isn't, then he doesn't mean the same thing. And you have to tell him the thing. It affects missions. Yes, it's true. But Anselm calls this the natural word. He says, it is because these words exist that other words have been invented. Hence, where there exists a natural word, you know, nature again, A equals A, one does not need any other word to pick the thing out, and where no natural word is possible, one cannot use any other word to point the thing out. We can also say, without absurdity, that natural words are truer insofar as they resemble and designate their objects more manifestly. Man, that affects preaching too. Don't use that word. Don't use that word. Don't talk like that. If I do another word, it won't mean the same thing. To which my audience doesn't care because they don't see the thing yet, which is why I have to create the category. There's no shortcutting that. I have to use the word propitiation. All the other things you mean by that don't mean the same thing. I have to use that word and then I'll explain it. Okay? But you don't mean the same thing unless you use the word, what he means by the natural word. So think of Bible study and natural naming. And you'll see, same thing as Augustine was pointing out in his book on Christian doctrine. You have to mean the thing. And you have to mean the sum of its nature. Or you don't mean the same thing. And that matters. Alright. There's just a little synopsis. I mean, just really just scratching the surface. I know today was highly complex. But you're going to see this now in the rest of Anselm's doctrine. You're going to see it. We've already seen it in his doctrine of God. You'll see it in his doctrine of Christ, the God-man, the universal essential man. This is going to become important. The universe, him being God-man, him being the object of a mediator. You're going to see this in his view on the Lord's Supper. You're going to see this in his view on Scripture, his view on salvation, his view on the will, the free will, the existence of evil, the fall of the devil, the ministry of the Spirit. You have to mean the actual nature of that object, or you're going to wind up not meaning anything at all, or something really, really, really bad. So let me open it up to questions or comments. Yep.
Okay, I have a twofold question. Basically, has realism and or scholasticism been the ultimate cause of the, rejection of or misuse of art and doctrine of ecology, and have response to that in Christian circles that the opposite is expected to embrace a pantheistic worldview and trying to correct that? Or am I thinking right there?
It's been claimed by many authors, particularly evangelical authors, but also secular scholars. And by the way, always watch it when all men speak well of you, including when all men wind up agreeing with you. Always be careful with Christian books. Raise red flags whenever Christian books start agreeing with the most, vociferous atheists. Always raise up an eyebrow and a red flag at that point, because you're probably getting a spoonful of atheism in your evangelical, brilliant author. Scholasticism, by the way, is not the essence of this, first of all. So is there a non-realistic scholasticism? Yes. It was within scholasticism that realism died. So the last thing I want to do is champion scholasticism as an end in itself. Because then you'll have guys like John Scotus Duns, who are defending realism on a bad basis, and on the opposite end of the spectrum, William of Ockham, who does so much damage and is so highly praised for doing so by evangelical authors put out by Crossway. Not trying to lay a guilt trip on anybody at Crossway, but since you don't know what you're talking about, you might want to go back and read. And it's so embarrassing when Catholic authors get this right, and evangelical authors don't. Okay? Scholasticism is a method. It's a method of questioning and answering and objections. It's the system that the university was built upon, but it's not the metaphysic that it was built upon. So this is only, in one sense, this is kind of a glass that you could pour water into or cyanide. There was also a Protestant scholasticism that people are not a big fan of today because Reformed people were just trying to take Reformed theology seriously in logical categories, and that always irritates everybody. Because then you got two strikes. Reformed theology, which everybody hates because it's true, and logical rigor, people actually saying, hey, pay attention to this in itself, and 800 pages instead of a little soundbite. So scholasticism is just, as the name suggests, serious, logical, rigorous, systematic theology, which is why. Examine, consider the source. Think of who's raising the objection and why and see what's used. There's a difference between the object of scholasticism versus how humans have used it versus the perversion of it and so on and so forth. So we have an objective view. So this view, realism, helps us address that question. That person, the critic, is not addressing the object of scholasticism. We could say, don't books to get us into trouble? Right? So much harm has come from books. So much harm has come out of Germany. My goodness. Down with the Germans. Or France. But no, they've had a lot to contribute. And so that's you're confusing the object of German and Frenchness with the misuse of it. And so it's the same thing with scholasticism. Yeah, Luther unfortunately learned his realism from Nicholas of Cusa, who unfortunately got filtered down through John Scotus Duns. They didn't understand Aquinas' version of it, and they didn't understand Anselm's. And that led to Luther somewhat ignorantly lashing out against Aristotle as the great pagan whore. Affectionately, the great pagan whore. But not that you must defend Aristotle. Aquinas did so the way he did to show that the Christian worldview could make sense of him and his categories better than Islam. It was Christianity versus Islam rather than a baptism of Aristotle into Christianese. So historical backdrop's important there, which, by the way, week one of the Aquinas class, we'll get to the historical backdrop there. Evangelical scholarship has gone from bad to worse since after Schaeffer. And they've done more with it, with better wrapping paper. So there is the allure that we're actually responding to the call of scholarship, and we're not.
There was like this hippie commune, and they were supposedly having pagan grape stomps. Well, he went over there to see, and he said, you're the first person from the Kratz Ravine that we've shown this to.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and it was beautiful. And the guy looked over and said, look at that now. Look at that school now. He said, isn't that ugly? And he had to admit, yeah, it is. And so he was talking about, how this loss of the appreciation of beauty and a doctrine of ecology.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was thinking, that there's danger misrepresenting authentic scholasticism rescues those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because if there's a good ecology, for example, or a good beauty, what is that? Is there an essence of beauty and a perversion of it? How can you tell the beautiful from the ugly? Unless you have the idea of the beautiful. How can I obey Paul in Philippians where he says, whatever's lovely, whatever's, and he gives you that list, think on these things. If they're not things that transcend the particular things that that are participating in them or deviating from them, how can I think on those things? Everything falls if realism falls. Realism is just properly named, so named, because it's reality. It's realityism. It's for people that aren't... Ouch, that was a bad way to say it. It's for people that love reality. I was going to say something pretty mean. But true, because it is a perversion of reality to cultivate a distaste for it and to develop a language which is resistant toward it. That's a nicer way to say it.